This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. The demand is high for housing in North Carolina. In almost every metropolitan area of the state, new rental developments are popping up with colorful paint schemes and faux wood hardwood floors, and it reflects the state's attractiveness to a growing number of young professionals who move here from across the nation. At the same time, there is a growing demand for affordable housing to lower-income working families, and that demand is going unmet. There are countless examples across the state of projects that have resulted in a net loss of affordable housing. We'll start with one example in Raleigh. The city's housing authority has redeveloped three public housing communities by creating mixed-income apartment complexes. The News and Observer's Andrew Kenny has been reporting on affordable housing in Raleigh and joins us now to talk about the newest development, Walnut Terrace. Hello, Andy.
Hi, Frank. Thanks for having me.
Tell me about Walnut Terrace. What is it and what's it look like and what is it replacing?
Well, Walnut Terrace is the biggest example of the city's pursuit of this increasingly popular strategy where instead of having, well, this place was originally built in 1958, and it was just rows of hundreds of pretty low-quality apartments. They had very few services. It was not a good-looking community, and it had a bad reputation here in Raleigh. A few years ago, they redeveloped it, and what they've built in its place would look almost like any mid-market subdivision that you'd see anywhere. It's a mix of single-family homes, townhouses, apartments, and I took a tour a couple weeks ago. They're absolutely gorgeous. You've got those faux hardwood floors that you mentioned. They're much more handicap accessible, but it's also come with a change in who the community is aimed at. Whereas before, go on.
Well, yeah, and you can continue because I think you're about to answer my question, so go ahead.
So whereas before, this community was entirely public housing, which means that it was offered only at subsidized rents to people who were making a certain fraction of the median income. Now about half of the 300 units have been converted to what we call market rate, which means that they're rented out at rates that are pretty comparable to what you'd see anywhere else in the city. And the Raleigh Housing Authority tells me that they built some of these units purposefully aiming to bring in your downtown professionals, your younger people, younger families. And that's part of a kind of a new philosophy in affordable housing that says you want to mix together different income levels and that that's going to be better for the community as a whole. But the trade-off is that more of your units cost more rent.
Well, so if I've done the math right, you were talking about the loss, the net loss of 150 public housing units. Am I right about that?
That's right. It's important to note that some of those fair market units, 75% of them are limited in who they can be rented to. They still have income limits on them, but they're going to be a higher rent.
All right. So the mixed use theory, I mean, we can sort of intuitively understand it's nicer to mix people and get things better integrated in your community than keep things apart. But if it results in a net loss, that can obviously be troubling. Is there any requirement that the city match one for one the public housing? Do they have any restrictions on the money they receive at the federal level or state level to make sure they don't lose housing?
I can't speak for the full set of requirements on them, but they've been moving away from public housing units. Over the last 16 years, the total number of public housing units, and those are those units we mentioned before, which are specifically restricted to lower income levels and have subsidized rents, the total number of those units has shrunk from 2,000 in 1998 down to about 1,300 now. And in their place, the city is giving out housing vouchers, building fair market units, or I should say the Raleigh Housing Authority is giving out more vouchers that you can spend at privately owned apartments. And they're moving away from the public housing model.
Sure, and that sounds great, too. How about if I give you the money and you go find a place on your own, and then we'll really spread things around pretty easily? The problem is there are limits on that in terms of the total rent that you'll pay. There's a certain percentage of the renter's rent that they pay, and then the city or the jurisdiction, whatever, the public money, covers the rest up to a certain amount. And the problem is, as I understand it, finding units that are that affordable, right?
That's right. Landlords are under no obligation, I believe, to accept these vouchers. So, and there you run into some of the stigma of affordable housing. It's not easy to convince landlords that they should accommodate this program.
And you literally have people with vouchers in their hands, and they can't find the housing. So the money's been allocated, it's available, but because of the limits and the restrictions and the kind of housing that's built and available, they can't even use them. So you've got people on waiting lists for public housing, you've got people with vouchers in their hands, and they can't find units, and then the total number of affordable units is shrinking in the city. I mean, have I painted a pretty clear picture of, you know, part of what's going on here?
The total number of those public housing units is shrinking. You've also got nonprofit developers like DHIC building hundreds or thousands of units. But in any case, the demand is clear. The waiting list to get a public housing unit from the Raleigh Housing Authority is up to several years at this point. And on top of that, the waiting list to get a voucher is also several years for many people.
All right. Well, and we're talking about a situation in Raleigh with Andy Kenny, who reports from the News and Observer. Asheville residents in Asheville, North Carolina, worried about the same thing. We talked to David Forbes a little while ago from the Carolina Public Press about that issue last month, and here's what he had to say about what's going on in Asheville.
So Asheville's Public Housing Authority, like many across the country, has faced very severe cuts, 20% about 2-3 years ago. And due to that, they're opting for a program called RAD, Rental Assistance Demonstration. And this allows Housing Authority to shift funding streams for some of its projects from traditional public housing funding, which has a lot of restrictions on them and have faced a number of fairly severe cuts, to Section 8 funding. And which is traditionally used for vouchers. And most housing authorities have done this for maybe 20, 30% of their projects. Asheville's going pretty much for every unit that the authority owns and manages. And this funding has less restrictions, some would even call them protections, on how it's used. So it's much more open to public-private partnerships than before.
And that would be in the redevelopment, because Section 8 itself, does this change the rules? That's a pretty restrictive program in terms of, you know, who can be included and under what terms you can stay and you can rent, that sort of thing.
Indeed. Well, this is coming from Section 8 funds, these are being used to fund traditional housing projects. Mm-hmm. These aren't vouchers the way that Section 8 is normally thought of. And this is kind of a big change in federal law. And while it is still restrictive, it does have – it still has less restrictions on it than traditional public housing funds do. And as a matter of fact, the city and the Housing Authority, which are two separate entities, are considering redevelopments of Asheville's oldest project as we speak.
So this is very interesting. I mean, this is the kind of thing that gets a little bit geeky, but it's important to understand, right? Because, first of all, there are cuts in assistance to public housing. One way to manage that would be to take this reshaped Section 8, which was very restrictive about getting money to people who needed housing help, and saying, well, if you agree to take that money out of Section 8 where all the restrictions are and spend it this way where there are fewer restrictions, that might make up for the funding that we cut. That's sort of what's going on here in some ways.
That's the thinking. The thinking is that Section 8 funding has been far more stable, and it will allow the Housing Authority to stop hemorrhaging funds, for one, but also potentially to improve some of these very old housing projects in Asheville.
That's David Forbes of the Carolina Public Press talking about the issue of public housing in Asheville on the state of things. Also, we've been talking with Andy Kenny of the News and Observer, and we introduce now Satana DeBerry, who is executive director of the North Carolina Housing Coalition. That organization works for decent, affordable housing and low and moderate income housing for a low and moderate income North Carolinian. Satana, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Give us the scope. We've heard a couple of examples of these changes now in theory, but maybe we should step back and talk about the demand, the need for affordable housing in North Carolina.
Sure, Frank. When we talk about affordable housing, it's much larger than public housing. I think that's what people traditionally think of when they think about affordable housing. But public housing is just one very small sector of affordable housing. When we talk about affordable housing, we talk about generally housing that's affordable to people who make about 80% or below of the average median income. So we're talking about the folks in your community who may be municipal employees. They may work at fairly low-skilled jobs in the community, at health centers. They may be retail workers. They're generally people who work 40 hours a week and just cannot afford to live in those communities in which they live. And so this is a, we say there are about 2 million North Carolinians who need this kind of affordable housing and don't have it.
How has that demand changed over time? Has it grown? Has it shrunk?
Well, North Carolina has, you know, kind of typically been a low-density place, and we've been fairly rural. As we've urbanized and people have come to live in the cities, kind of the low density of our urban areas combined with massive population growth has just really created this need for apartments and rentals. And then we saw with the crisis in 2008, folks who might have been homeowners have now been washed into the rental market. So there's a great, there's a really huge demand for rental units in North Carolina.
All right. Well, we're going to talk more about this as our program continues and talk about even at the level of public housing, if we lose those units, what impact that has on people at low and modest incomes who need affordable housing. And we'll talk more about that today on The State of Things with Satana DeBerry. And I want to thank Andy Kenney from the News and Observer for being with us on the program. Thanks, Andy.
Thank you.
Satana will stay with us, and there is more just ahead as we talk about affordable housing in North Carolina on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio, today talking about affordable housing in North Carolina. Conservative estimates say nearly 2 million people in the state are living in substandard conditions. Find out what that means. Satana DeBerry is executive director of the North Carolina Housing Coalition. It's an organization working for decent and affordable housing for low and moderate income North Carolinians. And she's talking about giving us the big picture. So if what does that mean? 2 million North Carolinians are living in substandard housing. What kind of housing is that?
Sure. So when we talk about substandard housing, we mean one, housing that is that people can't afford, but also we mean places where really people shouldn't be living, where they or they shouldn't be living long term. So when people can't afford a market rate apartment or there's no place that they can afford to rent in the community, they tend to end up in the private market. And the private market has certain abuses. It tends to be the homes tend to be not well cared for. Sometimes the landlords are as low income as the tenants and can't afford to keep them up. And so people live with limited water, limited heat. They may have structural issues, health and safety code violations. And then there's a certain number of people who can't even afford those places and end up in places like hotels where they rent weekly or monthly or even nightly because that's all they can afford. They can't get together the down payment to live somewhere else. And so they may end up paying twice what they would be paying out in the rental market to stay in a hotel where they really don't have the amenities of home.
So you've got this picture. You've got obviously a commercial housing market that is, you know, for people who can afford. They've got good high-paying jobs. They're young professionals. They move into nice apartments, and we can build for them, and there's plenty of stock for them. There's public housing, which is housing ordinarily built by a jurisdiction at public expense, and then there's public assistance. But again, we see that more of that housing is going out of stock. It's leaving without being replaced. People with vouchers are having a hard time making ends meet, that the money they're given isn't enough to allow them to afford what's in the private market. So there's this giant gap. And then there are people living, as you say, in some cases in motels, paying an awful lot. We're going to hear from somebody who's facing that very difficulty right now. Helen Person is a single mother and a longtime nursing assistant. She was recently featured in a News and Observer article that focused on families living in single-unit hotels in Raleigh. Helen, welcome to the State of Things. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Can you tell us where do you work?
Huh?
Where do you work?
Oh, Wake Med.
You're working there, and where do you live?
In Raleigh.
You're living in a motel?
Uh-huh.
Tell us about that. Can you describe it for us?
You're talking about in a room?
Or? Yeah, yeah.
It's a small room with one bathroom, and it's not much space. It has two beds in it.
No, do you have any kind of kitchen facilities?
Just a refrigerator and a microwave.
And how much are you paying in rent?
It's like $279 a week.
That's over $1,100 a month, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you're paying $1,100 a month for a single room with no kitchen facilities and a bathroom. Who's living with you?
My children.
So if you, now I guess anybody would ask, well, if you have that, why can't can you find a different kind of a place, a more conventional apartment?
Because you have to have the first rent and a deposit.
And you can't. So you have to have all that cash together the first month, and also utility deposits as well. So all that has to be in hand before you can find a place. So you end up, I mean, that's a lot of money. And of course, I guess if that's what you're spending in rent, it's pretty hard for you to save anything at the end of a month, huh?
Yes, that's exactly right.
Well, have you applied for public housing?
Oh, no.
Have you ever lived in public housing?
No.
So, and then we're, in terms of transportation, how do you get back and forth to work?
I'll drive.
Let me see. And you're living, tell me again, who you're living with?
My daughters, three daughters and one son.
They get four kids and you living in that motel room, and you're paying $1,100 a month. Are there other options? I mean, do you consider, are there other sort of forms of assistance to even get you that first month or a loan or something that could get you out of that situation?
Oh, I'm working on it.
Yeah. Well, Helen, I want to thank you for talking with us.
Okay.
Helen Person is a mother. She is living in Raleigh, and she's given us some of her situation. We're talking about affordable housing today on The State of Things. Satana DeBerry is with me now and talking about Helen's situation. How common is that?
That's pretty common. I mean, here in the Triangle, you have to make about $35,000 a year to be able to afford what we call fair market rent, and that's a two-bedroom apartment, and that's around $800 or $900 a month. So somebody like Helen would save significantly if she could get into an apartment. But like she said, with credit checks, if you had any type of eviction, if you're a low wage person, you have slow pay or no pay issues. And it's difficult for folks like that to be able to find a place to live.
Well, Helen, by the way, has a GoFundMe campaign to help her and others raise money for that down payment. There's a link to that at our website. And as you say, Satana, she's just one of many people in North Carolina trying to find affordable housing. Bill Rowe is the director of advocacy at North Carolina Justice Center, and he's been working to help people in a variety of ways with these very problems. Bill, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Frank.
So a situation like this, I mean, it does seem $1,100. They just built new apartments right next door to us that are going for like $12,000, and they're upscale. I mean, I can't afford them. And so this seems like an absolutely insane situation, and it's being replicated all over the state. What do you do when people come to you and tell you that this is what they're doing?
Well, it's a huge problem for low-wage workers and other folks on fixed incomes. If they have any problem where they've been evicted in the past because they weren't able to pay rent or they've been unable to pay bills, sometimes medical bills because they may not have health insurance, that's going to show up on a credit check. And when there's such competition for apartments in the area, especially in the Triangle, landlords will screen folks out if they can't meet their credit checks. And so for Helen, she's caught up in that dilemma, which is a circle of not ever getting ahead. The only way she may save some money, and Satana was talking about that, is that she may go to the private market, but generally to get to the rents that would be lower for her to maybe be able to afford, she's going to go to private market housing. And usually if you find housing that's in the $300 or $400 range that is just on the market, something has to give in that business equation, and it's usually maintenance. And so you find a lot of housing that's not very well maintained. The repairs aren't done regularly. They're not well insulated. The heating systems may not work. And I've seen many clients over the years that I've represented folks in these problems of that's their housing of last resort. Those landlords may take folks without a credit check, but what those tenants lose then is a safe and decent place to live.
Well, let me tell you, it suggests to me, and you're the experts in this, so tell me why I'm wrong, that there is a market for this kind of housing. In other words, a commercial market. You're talking about somebody with a job. We've seen people with two incomes who are living in these motels, which means they really can't afford even to go around and figure out how to enlist your help, Bill, because they're very busy with childcare and everything else. Is there not a market for this that through some partnership of public-private, nonprofit, and otherwise, that you could create housing that would be commercially viable, respectable and safe housing that could operate at the level at those rents? Or is that just economically not possible?
Well, kind of between public housing and the private market, we have this group of rental apartments that have been developed through the federal low-income housing tax credit, which is a public-private partnership that helps developers build for folks who are generally between 60% and below of average median income. It has been wildly successful and is minuscule. In North Carolina, it builds less than 1,000 units a year. And so there really isn't, there's nothing out there in the market beyond the tax credit. And some of that just has to do with the way that rental housing is financed in the United States. It's pretty much a private equity market. Private investors demand a certain return, and that return comes from rents. And if you cannot charge high rents, you can't get that return back to investors.
I mean, that does suggest a kind of another form of investment pool where people who are willing to wait for slow money and lower returns, who had that as a mindset, if there were that pool available, and I knew that pot of money was there to invest in at a lower return, albeit at a higher risk, but apparently that's not available.
Well, and one of the problems we've suffered recently in North Carolina is that there was a state low-income housing tax credit program that worked along with the federal program to try to get rents down to probably close to what maybe Helen is earning, but for folks that are making probably in the range of $25,000 to $40,000 a year. That program's gone now in North Carolina. That tax credit program no longer exists. And so that's a substantial amount of resources not available for that investment. And we have this disconnect that has been going on for years, but with the recession has been exacerbated, where families' income is not keeping up with the cost of living or for rents. And so you have raising rents, you have stagnating wages, and you have a recovery that's really left out a lot of very low-wage folks or has created a lot of low-wage jobs. And there's not the ability to be able to afford the rents that are out there that are being created now with the successes in Durham and in Raleigh and Asheville that are attractive places where folks want to go and live.
And, of course, those successes, not intentionally, but actually make the problem worse because obviously real estate values rise and that just puts more and more pressure on rent.
That's right. And, yeah. I mean, the other, the other problem, of course, with any real estate business is that there's lots of interest involved. The cost of land can be very expensive, like you said, when you're in a very popular place. But then all the way along the line, some entity is selling something. And so you've got to buy materials. You've got to pay workers to do it. You got to borrow money. You're going to pay interest on that. And so there is a bottom line at some point of what it costs to provide that housing without regardless of factoring in what the profit needs to be for folks. So that's generally where there needs to be some way for the public sector to step in with the private sector to try to help these folks so they can find a place to live.
So, Dana, you were about to say something.
I was just going to say Bill makes a good point about wages. I mean, you need to make about $15 an hour in North Carolina to afford a decent two-bedroom rental. And most wage earners don't make that.
So what would it look like, Bill? I know you do some lobbying work. What are you lobbying for?
Well, what we would love to see is we've had two good programs in North Carolina. The North Carolina Housing Trust Fund that's been around now for probably over 25 years is a great housing resource that's flexible, can be used to be able to drive rents down or costs down for folks to either buy houses and also rent. But that funding has really stagnated and decreased over the last few years, particularly with the recession. As I said, we had a state housing tax credit that has ended because the state has really ended any commitment to tax credits. And what we have now is a non-recurring appropriation. So I think there's a great hope that program, which can help make the federal tax program work for lower income people and in the rural areas. That's one area that there is a disconnect between urban and rural, and in the rural areas, there's just not the housing stock, and so it needs to be developed, and the tax credit could work there. And so we're hoping there'll be some way, whether it's an appropriation or whatever, that will help to develop that housing and make it affordable for those folks, like Satana was saying, that make around $14, $15 an hour.
And the tax credit in its last year in North Carolina generated about $50 million to go towards affordable housing. So that's completely stripped out of the market now. That's a significant amount of money.
And I suppose, I don't know if either of you have done the research, Bill, I suspect when you're lobbying, trying to make the case, you can also talk about the benefit that what gets returned to the state or what gets lost when people are living in substandard housing. Can you give us the benefits of using, of creating a tax credit, using tax dollars to leverage this kind of housing?
Well, absolutely. And the Housing Coalition and Santana are great messengers on that as well. And I think almost everyone agrees that when you invest in the development of housing, you're putting people to work, and so you're creating jobs. If it's home ownership, you're also creating taxpayers. Even if it's just apartment buildings that are built, there's also an increase in the tax base. Besides, you're also giving people an affordable place to live. So unlike Helen, who's probably spending every penny that she makes, these folks will be spending roughly around 30% of their income for rent. So they have other resources to make sure they pay their bills, but can save and go out and spend in the economy. So the multiplier is huge for when you can put people in into affordable housing.
Satana, I know that you've also done research on this, and I don't know if there's anything to add to that.
Yeah, we'd say each unit equals about three jobs in a local economy. And those are local jobs. I mean, you can't outsource the building of an apartment building or the building of a home. And so those are jobs that tend to stay in those communities, provide jobs for subcontractors.
Let's get back to this mixed use theory, the idea that then I guess we've got two different stories. One of them is to change the rules about Section 8 spending to allow it to flow more freely into mixed use developments. But ultimately, it comes down to a theory that we're better off building mixed income facilities, blending people. Just in theory, does that make sense? But I guess in practice, we end up losing housing stock. So I want you both maybe to talk about, because it's catching on. We're finding more and more cities doing it, right?
Right. And I would think most people think it's a good idea, that I think we've learned from some of the histories in the past of just segregating hundreds and hundreds of very, very low income folks is not a good idea. And so I think most people will recognize that having mixed income communities, having availability of affordable housing throughout communities where there's lots of opportunities and services is a great thing to do. The disconnect, we've done that and not done the one-for-one replacement, so that when we lose 300 units or we lose 150 units at Walnut Terrace, there wasn't the same commitment either from state, local, or federal government to replace those 150 units in some way so that there's not that net loss. And so I think that's what's been missing over the years. And at one point in time, there was a requirement of a one-for-one replacement, recognizing that we need all the housing we can get. Mixed income is a great idea, but I don't think you have to do that at the expense of then losing this other housing. It takes resources, though.
And with mixed income developments, the neighborhoods around those public housing units also tended to be affordable. And so when you create a mixed income neighborhood, as Bill said, in theory, it's a great idea. But then also what we start to do is strip the affordability from the surrounding neighborhoods because it's nicer. People want to move there. And then people put private equity into moving there. And they use their money in the market to build around. And so we lose even more affordability for people who are maybe a little bit further up the income ladder than folks in public housing.
So is there a way this can work? We're working in a, you know, kind of in a market economy, and there's going to be a point at which any kind of public, interference is going to brush up against that private market. Is there a way to do this?
Well, I think it starts with first a commitment of recognizing that there's a problem. And I think our local governments are seeing that, and many of them are thinking about it. I don't think there's one answer. There's probably several of them, and it will involve the private sector. But first, we have to start with the commitment that we have to make sure that we're not displacing folks or not creating opportunities for them to find housing. Now, whether that is a mixture of private investment with public investment, if it's trying to induce or provide incentives so that homeowners or landlords will rent to folks, it can be any varied number of ideas. But we have to first start with that commitment. And there will have to be some resources. There's no way to intervene in the market and make the housing affordable for these folks without resources. And that's generally where the commitment has been lacking.
And local governments across North Carolina are starting to see that. We've seen movement in Chapel Hill. We've seen movement in Davidson, these smaller urban municipalities that really are running out of room, and how they can create affordability kind of within their town boundaries. But even some of the bigger cities, Raleigh, Charlotte, Durham, they're all starting to think now, Greensboro, Winston-Salem, about what resources the city has, like maybe their city-owned land that can be used by nonprofit developers to do tax credit developments or some type of other affordable housing.
And we'll take a look at one program in Charlotte that may have cracked the nut and also look at rural housing when our conversation continues. Right now I'm talking with Bill Rohl, the North Carolina Justice Center, and Satana DeBerry of the North Carolina Housing Coalition. There's more just ahead. Stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacia. We're talking about affordable housing in North Carolina today, talking about mixed-income housing in Raleigh and Asheville. Some of the concerns around these developments have been the loss of public housing and affordable housing, gentrification of communities. There seems to be something interesting going on in Charlotte, however, where Housing Authority has been able to redevelop without losing public housing units and has been able to improve the lives of citizens in the city as well. UNC professor and director of the Center for Urban and Regional Studies, Bill Rohl, is researching the issue, and he can talk with us about Charlotte's planning. Bill Rohl, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you.
So tell us about this. Tell us about the project that you've been looking into in Charlotte.
Yes, we've been looking at two projects with the support of the Housing Authority there. One is a Hope 6 project where the federal government provides large amounts of funds to the Housing Authority to redevelop some of the worst developments in a particular city. Charlotte used that money. In fact, this is their fifth Hope 6 grant, and they have redeveloped a project called Boulevard Homes. The new project being built on site is called the Renaissance, and it's beautiful.
And where is it? What part of the city is it?
It's in West Charlotte, out by the airport, actually very close to the airport. And we have particularly been looking at what happened to the people who were relocated from the project. One of the big criticisms of Hope 6 is that many people are relocated and a relatively small percentage end up coming back. So we were looking at that. The second project, which is of particular importance, I think, to this discussion, well, they're both important, is that we're doing an assessment of the Moving to Work program that Charlotte is one of 39 housing authorities across the country. And Moving to Work basically gives the housing authority the freedom and flexibility to move money around from public housing to Section 8 and to actually create new housing, to use it for social services, whatever they think is appropriate. And it also gives them waivers for to a lot of the regulations that HUD has on how you charge rents, whether you can have work requirements, and the like. So that's been our work over the last 5 years.
Take us to Hope 6. The people who have been displaced, are they coming back? Was there a net loss or gain in affordable housing units for those people?
Well, it's too soon to have the final percentage of how many people have moved back. But we have been following very closely people's intention to come back and reasons why they are not interested in coming back. And what we're finding is that a very large percentage really are happy where they are. They were relocated 3-4 years ago. Most of them got Section 8 certificates and were able to find private housing. So they're out of the projects. People don't want to come back to a project, even if it's a mixed-use project. Many of them are in single-family homes. They're in neighborhoods where they've created friendship friendships. They have a local church. They shop in the local stores. They just don't want to move again. So, but I can tell you this, and that is a very high percentage of them are very happy with how they've been treated, very happy in their new neighborhoods. They are just happy to be out of the worst public housing development at that time in Charlotte.
Well, that sounds like a success story. The problem that we've heard in other cities where things like this have been tried is that when people are asked to leave and handed that voucher, they just can't find another place. Or some people are waiting a long time even to be given the voucher to be part of Section 8. Why has that not happened if it hasn't in Charlotte?
Well, when you get Hope 6 grant, some of that money is for replacement housing. Now, Bill Rowe is exactly right that it used to be that they had to replace all the housing. Back in, I think it was 96, they changed the law and said, no, you don't have to replace all the housing. But there's still part of the grant review process is how much of the housing do you intend to replace? And they take that into consideration. Because Charlotte is a moving to work authority, it can move money around. So it was able to provide additional housing vouchers. It was able to provide assistance for people finding the units. They had counselors to help them, relocation counselors to help them. They had basically social counselors to help them deal with any kind of problems they were experiencing that might get in the way of them being successful homeowners. So they were able to really address that problem, I think, quite effectively.
Well, let me ask both of you, Satana and Bill. I'll start with you, Satana, how this sounds. Is it too early to tell, or is there anything in this that might serve as a model in other places?
I think probably both. The real problem with Section 8 we're finding is with these Section 8 vouchers is that, as Bill said earlier, not every landlords aren't required to take them. So folks end up in neighborhoods where landlords are required to take them, which in the case of a place like Raleigh has meant Southeast Raleigh, which was already kind of the poorest zip code in Raleigh. And so we're really seeing that we're just moving the concentration of poverty from one end of town to the other.
Yeah, and I would add, and I think learning more about Charlotte's program, two big takeaways there are. One is monitoring where people have gone after their Hope 6. I don't think there have been many housing authorities who have done that sort of monitoring, and so they're lost. And I think the efforts that Professor Rowe talks about is exactly what you need to be doing, which is helping with extra assistance, the counseling. And sometimes you may have to modify your program depending on how you can move money around to adjust the rents that could be subsidized. And so that can help people, particularly in a market where the rents are very high. It's a downturn that you may have less vouchers, but you may be able to help people find the housing. And, you know, one market in particular, Chapel Hill, which is dominated by the university system, it's now becoming a crisis there for folks with housing choice vouchers to find housing in Chapel Hill because landlords have found I don't need to accept these. And some are actually saying people who they've rented to for a few years say, we're not going to rent to you anymore. We don't need to take Section 8. And so there has to be some creativity and step up from the housing authorities and from the local government. I think there's many lessons to be learned from what Charlotte is doing in their activities.
It sounds like moving to work gave you greater flexibility in how you can use the money, but did place more restrictions on the renters. Am I getting that right in terms of requirements on being at work? Were there any other requirements for renters?
The real objective of the Moving to Work program is to experiment with different ways of providing public and assistant housing. So one of the things that Charlotte is experimenting with are work requirements. So in five of their public housing developments, they are telling people, we're going to give you a year of social services, a case manager to help you deal with whatever obstacle you're having in getting a job. And then afterwards, we're going to expect you to work at least 15 hours a week. And after the second year, we're going to expect you to work 30 hours a week. And so they have rolled that out in these five developments, and they are experimenting with how effective it is. And our early informal result here is that, according to the case managers, the fact that there is a requirement is causing many people who otherwise would say, well, I don't have to work. Why should I go to work? Now they're feeling like, well, I do need to go to work, and they're starting to get serious about preparing themselves for work and actually getting jobs. We talk about the shortage of public housing. Well, one way is to build more. Another way is to help people move through, right, graduate from it. And do we want people being in housing assistance their entire lives? What about all these other people that qualify who are on the waiting list and aren't getting that assistance? So it's at the same time, you don't want to put people out on the street. So it's kind of a balancing act to say, what are the carrots, which is the services and assistance, and what's the stick, which is, okay, we're going to start sanctioning you if you don't make a good faith effort to get out there and get a job.
Well, we've been talking about urban areas so far, but rural areas are experiencing this as well. And my next guest would say the problem is even worse there. Ned Fowler has been working with many fields that directly correspond. He is with Housing in North Carolina. He's the president and CEO of Northwestern Housing Enterprises. He's bid on federal housing tax credits. And Ned Fowler joins us now from Boone. Hello, Ned.
Hi, Frank.
Good to have you here. Tell us about the situation in Western North Carolina.
Thank you, Frank. We have a situation that's similar to what Bill Rowe was describing in Chapel Hill. Our service areas centered around Boone, which, of course, is home to Appalachian State University, the fourth largest in the state university system. And so here in Watauga County and in surrounding rural counties in northwestern North Carolina, we have a problem not only of rental affordability, but also availability, a shortage of housing stock. And so our 2,000-unit voucher program at Northwest Housing is fully subscribed all the time, but it is true that newly minted voucher holders who are going out on the market, doing their housing search function and looking for decent units to rent with voucher in hand are having a very difficult time locating those units. And for that reason, our boards, both the public and the private nonprofit boards that I work with here in northwestern North Carolina, we have a very strong production orientation.
Well, what are the obstacles? Let's stop there, because that does sound like housing stock in your case is really critical. There's just not enough space available, right? Housing space. How do you do that? How do you build? Because we've talked about the affordability, a bottom line. There's a certain, it cost you this much to build it, and you've got to collect at least that much rent. What are the obstacles to creating new stock?
Well, Satana mentioned the low-income housing tax credit program, and really, in America and across the state and in our portion of the state in the Blue Ridge here, the only way to build affordable rental housing is to use the federal housing tax credit program. Used to be many, many years ago, we could have gone to the bank with a savings and loan. We'd borrow money. We would build apartments and we'd rent them out. One could still do that, but if you did, you'd be charging, $1,200, $1,400, $1,600 a month for those units, because the cost of developing and owning and maintaining that housing would drive the rental amounts up in that way. And of course, the federal housing tax credit program brings those, because of the infusion of private equity, it brings those rents down to levels that are affordable to folks that need it.
Well, let me ask you, Bill Rowe, the idea, the flexibility sounds like it's promising, at least, flexibility with how you use those funds. But it does sound like what Ned is saying, and I think everybody has said so far, there has to be public spending on affordable housing in order for it to work. The public must spend on this. It has to come out of us.
Oh, right? No question about it. No question about it. One of the questions is how which levels of government should get involved. And traditionally, it's been local government looking to the federal government to provide all the subsidy. Since the federal government is pulling out slowly of with the funds that are needed, it's important that the state steps up, and it's important that local government steps up. So at the local level, there are lots of things that can be done. Many cities have excess land. They can give those parcels for – usually they sell them for a dollar to an affordable housing producer. Chapel Hill and many other cities around the state have done that. There are land banks. There are ways to simplify development codes to allow the development of affordable housing. There are inclusionary zoning ordinances.
So that can be done at the local level.
Mentioned.
And then
yep.
Bill Rowe, but at the very moment when the federal government is pulling back and the state, as Bill Rowe suggested, might be should step up, this state has been stepping back, right? Is that right? In terms of its commitment to public housing.
Well, that's correct. I mean, we went through a difficult time since 2008 with our budget, and so there were cuts that were made then, but those cuts have continued.
They haven't been restored.
And they haven't been restored.
The economy is improving.
That's exactly right.
Yep. And Ned, talk about municipalities in rural areas. I guess that's difficult because you don't have large municipalities. Is that a different problem, or is there as much flexibility and can as much be done at the local level as Bill Rowe was suggesting in urban areas?
There really are quite a few things that local governments can do, not in a big money way, but some of the things that Professor Rowley was mentioning can certainly be effective in rural areas. We have 7 counties and 19 small municipalities, the largest of which is Boone, that we serve, and several of them have stepped forward to assist with affordable housing development in particularly in the form of passing through federal or state resources that can come through local government, occasionally inclusionary zoning, where developers are going to build it anyway, and you're going to hold their feet to the fire with respect to green space and several other quality requirements with local ordinance, and so why not include a provision that requires them to build a percentage of those units affordable to those that you're trying to help.
Well, I want to thank all of you for being on the program. Ned Fowler is president and CEO of the Northwestern Housing Enterprises in Boone, North Carolina. Satana DeBerry is executive director of the North Carolina Housing Coalition. Bill Rowe is director of advocacy at the North Carolina Justice Center. And Bill Rowe is a professor at the University of North Carolina and the director of the Center for Urban and Regional Studies. Thank all of you for being on the program. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Frank.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to The State of Things. You can find out more information at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mawagdi, and Will Michaels. Robin Copley is our technical director. Jess Clark is our intern. Our news director at WUNC is Brent Wolf. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.